Chris Preston.
And I'm Brad Zimmerman.
And welcome to Street Check, the best podcast in the history of Cabot Wealth Network. I'm going to just keep saying it until someone tells me otherwise. Brad, we know that people come to this podcast primarily to get the news. Right. And we have some breaking news right at the top here. The news that we just saw like literally 5 minutes ago, which means it'll probably be old news by the time this podcast actually sees the light of day. But Brad, what is the breaking news?
So first, it will still be breaking news. Credit to producer Madison for turning these around very quickly, getting them posted pretty much immediately after record.
Yeah, no pressure. Yeah.
But the breaking news is the National Association of Realtors has agreed to restructure how people pay real estate commissions. Essentially, it's the end of 6% real estate commissions for sellers, because in the past, they would one of the components of selling your property was offering a specific percentage to the buyer's agent. That practice will end per this proposed settlement in mid-July. It has to be accepted by a federal court, but it's largely what I think antitrust regulators and enforcement agencies and stuff like that were looking for. So end of the 6% commission, actual real breaking news for once.
Instead it makes of just me want to sell my house right now, which I mean, I imagine people who have been on the fence are reluctant to do so in this sort of slowed market that probably will make a huge difference for them and thus for realty companies and by proxy, you know, housing type stocks. Too early to tell that. But I mean, I guess from an investment perspective, that's sort of the takeaway, right?
Yeah, I think the expectation is that it's going to be slow to sort of matriculate through because people are still very accustomed to the way we've been doing it for years, but it'll prompt more competition for probably next generation buying agency groups that are offering more a la carte services like, hey, we can vet this area for you and we can do this at a fixed rate versus where it's been sort of this all-inclusive price fix kind of style before. But again, changes are not proposed until mid-July. So if you're selling, you've still got a few months to wait. Should you wait? I don't know. I think this, you know, if you're a home buyer or if you're a homeowner right now and you're debating selling, tacking on a couple of extra months and the variability of interest rates and what that does to buyers, it seems like maybe more risk than saving 2.5% or 3%. But it's going to be a significant change to the industry. And it's something that I'll be curious to talk to Nancy Zambella about next time we have her on.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll definitely have to have her back on to talk about that at some point. So there you go. Breaking news, what you came here for. Okay. Now let's, let's get into Brad. What's the rundown of what we're going to talk about today?
So we've got our normal big three. We're going to start with the bull market sort of shrugging off the inflation data. I think Chris and I are maybe on different sides of that a little bit, but we'll get further into that. Hybrid cars seem to be revitalizing traditional automakers in the last few months. EV stocks have been coming down a little bit, and Chris has some stats on the buyer preference element. Then we're going to talk about Boeing and the impact that's having on airline stocks, if any. And then after that, we're going to go through some spring cleaning tips for portfolios. So we're past the year-end window dressing. We're through our first earnings season, summer coming up. What steps can you take to pare down portfolios that might have been outperforming because of the bull market, get rid of losers, stuff like that.
Yeah. It may be spring where you are, but by the way, I'm not here in Vermont yet.
Yeah. It's sunny 55 right now. It's barreling into summer, but before we get to that, as always, defend the take. Chris, you're going to have 90 seconds. Your take this week: if you're worried, you should be buying. And if you're super bullish in this current market, you should be a seller.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the classic, you know, buy when there's blood on the streets and what is the Warren Buffett line? Be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. I don't know if that's the exact line, but, you know, the market, as they say, climbs a wall of worry. And I'd say in general, there's enough worry still out there, but there are pockets where there's a lot of exuberance, and AI is certainly one of them. You know, if you're someone who thinks that this AI is an unstoppable trend that's going to carry stocks higher in perpetuity, you might want to consider paring back a little bit, just to hedge a little bit. You might be too exuberant and you could be in for a rude awakening, especially if you're loaded up on AI related plays and don't have a whole lot of diversity in your portfolio. Now, if you're just worried and just like thinking, oh, the stocks are too high, you know, there's no way they can go higher from here. Well, bull markets tend to last longer, as we've said many times here, than anyone expects. And, you know, market climbs a wall of worry, all those cliches. Maybe you should do some buying. Don't tighten the purse strings now just because you think that time is going to be the reason that stocks start falling, because history says that's not the case. So it's more just, if you're one direction or the other, maybe do the opposite.
All right. Time. Hit the post. Michael Brush shared internally some recent Bank of America investor sentiment data that showed on a scale of like 1 to 5, the bullishness, bearishness levels. And it was like just getting into the worry zone, not wall of worries, but like it was getting exuberant. I think on a scale of 1 to 5, it came in at a 4, which is typically when retail investors are getting a little bit overheated. But I think that's a good way for us to transition to inflation and to the bull market's response to some of those latest numbers.
Yeah. So the CPI print came out this week is slightly higher than expected. I think it was 3.1% month over month expected for February, and it was 3.2. Is that right?
Versus the year ago.
Yeah, versus a year ago. And then month over month, it was 0.4%, where 0.3 was expected.
I think 0.3, 0.4 was the expectation. So, it was roughly,
you know, not a big difference. I guess the overriding point or takeaway is that inflation is sticky. It sliced in a third from 9% 2 summers ago to 3% fairly quickly. But pushing through that 3%, I guess we'll call it resistance or barrier, has been proven more difficult. So the 3% level, 3% inflation has been pretty sticky. Stocks have mostly held up pretty well since, you know, we're not in the same climate like in the bear market where, you know, missing by 0.1, being 0.1% higher than expected was a 2 to 3% dip in the market. But, you know, stocks have been mostly sort of stuck in play. So it seems like two things are butting heads right now. The power of this bull market up against sticky inflation. What will win? You know, I guess the point is that it's not doing damage much now, even though it's pretty clear the Fed's not going to cut rates till at least June. Some, you know, the percentage of them even doing that is falling. It seems like two things are butting heads, but that the sticky inflation isn't doing the kind of damage that some feared it might if it stuck around this long because of how strong the bull market is. Fair?
I think to a degree, the expectations now for the June Fed meeting, it has gone from 26.6% that they're going to hold rates steady to 43.8%. We also had the producer price index, which was up 0.6% month over month, which was double the expectation. And then the 10-year treasury yield is up 23 basis points in the last week. One thing that Mike had written fairly recently, Mike Santolo, that is, was how much from like November through now, or through the end of February, the bulls had really just steamrolled any kind of resistance. There was no real pushback. It was essentially straight up rally for tech, especially. I think we maybe have talked about it feeling a little bit toppy lately. I don't know if we've talked about it on the pod specifically, but there's definitely, I think, signs now that the bears are putting up more of a fight. I'll put it that way. Whether it becomes sort of a much needed breather for what's been a nonstop rally, or whether it turns into an actual slowdown and we consolidate sideways for a little bit, I don't know, but the Bears are definitely putting up more of a fight, and I do think there are cracks in the armor, or kinks in the armor, I guess is the way to say that these days. Yep. Kinks in the armor of the Bulls. I don't think we're just going to keep going straight up indefinitely. We've been sort of caught. We've been maybe more cautious, or I've been a little bit more cautious than I think a lot of the Uber Bulls have. But you've still got doomsayers out there. Jeremy Grantham, is that the?
Yeah. Anyway,
came out Grantham. Called AI a bubble within a bubble. He's uber bearish right now. Thinks that the Fed action and the AI action from 2022 was essentially a Band-Aid on what was going to be a significant bear market. And now that the air is coming out of that balloon, that maybe that points us lower. But most Wall Street analysts have higher price targets on the S&P. I do think that we're seeing a change in character in the market. It's too premature to say, though, this is going to be a reversal. I think we're just seeing more contested forward movement.
Yeah. I mean, as I found out in my Defend the Take, 2-3 weeks ago, when I said S&P is now hitting a top, I was wrong. You know, it's immediately has gone to newer highs. It has slowed a bit the last week or two. But betting against this market has been a fool's errand. Are we going to see the same kind of run-up we've saw from, you know, November through February? Probably not. And I think, you know, as we always see, there's always some slowing as you get towards a presidential election. So imagine we'll run into that at some point too. I don't think we're going to see a huge pullback the way we might have in a weaker market with, you know, inflation sticking around this much or Fed pushing back cuts as much as they potentially are.
Yeah, I think part of the deciding factor is going to be how rotation plays out, because we're seeing rotation out of some of the early leaders, the AI names particularly, that, you know, NVIDIA is 10% off its all-time high, which it hit while we were recording the streeties and while we were just lauding it with praise nonstop.
As we were saying, there's NVIDIA's market and we're all living in it. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. So our track record as being counter indicators remains flawless.
Yeah.
But I think it depends on how rotation looks, right? Like if we rotate out of AI and out of the semiconductor names and into other segments of the market, then I think you can sustain a continued rally. If we see rotation into cash, which if we see, you know, 10-year, if we see treasury yields start rising, that becomes maybe more attractive. You know, if we're looking at 9% gains for the S&P for the balance of the year, according to like Goldman Sachs or Bank of America or whomever, there's less of an incentive to rush to equities versus just saying, okay, well, I'm just going to accept 5% cash because I'm still getting that. So the Fed is still going to pull strings on the overall macro environment. And I think it'll help sort of set direction, which unfortunately means we'll keep talking about it. But I think the investor sentiment and how people choose to rotate their gains out of these early leaders is going to ultimately decide the fate of the bull market.
Yeah. Okay. That's enough Fed inflation talk for 1 week. Let's move on to a more fun topic. So number two, the big three. I wrote about this week. So EVs, EV stocks, electric vehicle stocks were all the rage for, especially at, you know, 2020, 2021, the post COVID, you know, boost in many growthy things. And, you know, people started buying electric vehicles. That's right around the time I started seeing Rivians pop up around here. Although you say you don't see them much in Arizona. But the EV market led by Tesla has clearly hit a little bit of a rough patch. Growth has slowed. And people, hybrids have sort of gotten where people are pivoting. I can speak to this firsthand. So in spirit, my wife and I, we wanted to buy an electric car. But, you know, when this was a year ago, a little over a year ago, we settled on a hybrid because for several reasons. A, you know, we live in Vermont and, you know, the idea of having an electric car, I don't know that those are built for snow. Many of those aren't built for snowy conditions as much as, you know, maybe a hybrid would be. But also there's cost and just the practicality of like, hey, if we're on a road trip, like, so we have to, you know, are we going to have enough places to, you know, recharge, which, you know, all my friends who have electric cars, I think the answer is yes, but it was a concern. So we settled on a hybrid, and we're not alone. So hybrid sales last year were up 65% versus electric vehicles were up 46%. You know, obviously both are still growing quite a bit. But when you include plug-ins, roughly 10% of all new cars purchased in the U.S. last year were hybrids versus 7.5%, 7.6% market share for pure electrics. And we're seeing that in hybrid stocks. Toyota, I mean, these are hiding in plain sight companies. They're big name companies that have pivoted heavily to hybrids. Toyota is up, TM, ticker symbol, up 69% in the last year. And already 27% year to date, and yet it's still cheap. It's like less than 12 times forward earnings, about one time sales. Honda is up 33% in the last year, 13% year to date. And it's super cheap still, 7.5 times forward earnings. Price to sales is 0.44. This is because by pivoting so sharply to hybrids, these big companies have found sort of new revenue streams. You know, Honda's hybrid sales nearly tripled in 2023, 294,000 units. You know, Toyota has said that Toyota Camry is the top selling car in America, and they've said that it'll be hybrid only by next year, 2025. You know, Toyota has always been sort of forward thinking about hybrids, you know, dating back to like 1997 with the launch of the Prius. And they're now, hybrids are now 27% of its total US sales and expect to be 40% by the end of this year. My point is, those who are bullish on electric vehicles, I think a pivot to hybrids is not only a there's better growth right now, but these are sort of lower risk companies. Honda, Toyota, those are, you know, those have been around forever. It's not like taking a flyer on a Rivian or even a BYD. Anyway, I took a lot of time. I'll let you weigh in.
No, I'm glad you did, because I haven't looked too hard at those sales numbers. You know, talking about Rivian, down 47.5% year to date. You know, there may be an element, and obviously, I say obviously, but you know, Fisker, FSR is the ticker, dropped 50% in the last week, 57%. They're trading at 16 cents a share on bankruptcy fears. They got a little bit of a bump on maybe some rumors that some major automaker is going to come in and rescue them. But I do think that this confluence of factors where cheap money is effectively drying up, we probably swung too far pendulum wise to EVs away from ICE cars, right? I mean, I certainly remember when Teslas first came out, where it was this the wave of the future, next generation, and people were, because you could get money inexpensively and everything was, you know, relatively affordable, were really quick to dive into it. And then after a few years, we started to see the real limitations of the technologies, right? Like, it's more expensive to get one fixed. If your battery goes, that becomes really expensive. Charging infrastructure is still a problem. And I don't know when the first Tesla rolled off the line, but it must have been, what, 2008, 2010, something around there?
I'll look it up while you vamp. Yeah.
So the first Tesla rolls off the line and everybody's excited. I say everybody, a certain subset of the population is super excited about this new EV wave of the future. But the realities of it have increasingly been priced in. It's tough to lose money selling cars. The thing that launched Tesla into the stratosphere was they could afford to not make money on car sales because they could monetize carbon offset credits. It was cheap to borrow money, and those conditions have dried up. So I certainly think it'll be very challenging for a Fisker or a Rivian or another EV competitor. BYD, maybe not. They may have sort of past that hurdle while conditions were still pretty solid. But we've seen
Hurts 2008, you're right, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah. So we've seen Hurts pivot away from their EV offerings. The major automakers, they're going to take losses on their EV units in all likelihood. I think the Ford F-150 Lightning was, I think they lost five figures per sale, if I recall correctly. That I don't have numbers to back that up. But I think we swung the pendulum too far towards EVs, and now we're swinging back in the other direction. And EVs or hybrids seem like a sort of natural landing spot where, hey, if you don't have access to the charging infrastructure, you use it as a gas car. If you can do the battery plug-in thing overnight, great. If you don't even want to think about it and just want to drive around and fill up your tank, great, you can do that as well. So we see that oftentimes in the market where we swing too far in one direction or another. And I think we're just seeing that with EVs.
Yeah, I think eventually the EV market will mature and consolidate and mature. There'll be fewer players in there, but they'll have a bigger market share. But while that happens, I think investing in these big household name companies, Honda, Toyota, Hyundai, are all doing really well with hybrids. I think that's a good, you know, if you're wanting to bet on, the wave of the future automobiles, you know, hybrids are a good sort of similar to the way we are thinking and buying a car. Hybrids are sort of a nice happy medium. And right now it's been a good investment, has been for the last year, and they're still cheap because, you know, the earnings growth is considerable now with the way that people are snatching up hybrids from these big companies. Okay.
And credit, just a last point, credit to Toyota, because they were very resistant to the battery electric push for years, and they caught some flack for it. And in hindsight, it was well-deserved. Their forward thinking was really excellent with their strategy of not avoiding a migration to electric vehicles, but doing it incrementally by embracing the hybrid tech early. I think they saw it coming. So credit to Toyota there. And the reason I say it that way, or the reason I bring it up, is if you're going to favor one hybrid company over another, I would lean towards Toyota. They had the right call with the pivot to EV. There's no reason they can't make the right call as we progress through whatever the next generation of autos are or is.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so from one mode of transportation to another, airlines, our last big three item. Boeing, it's been a tough year for Boeing. Boeing, you know, as people probably know, in January, it's Alaska Airlines 737 MAX, the door blew off shortly after takeoff. Not good for business. I think everyone was at least relatively okay. And then in the last week, a 787 Dreamliner Boeing plane plunged mid-flight and injuring dozens. You know, safety is number one concern, I would say, among people who fly anywhere. And when those come into question, that's not good for business. It's been terrible for Boeing's business. Production is slowed as regulators sort of take a look at, scrutinize the company's practices. This led to, fewer flights being scheduled. There's a 6% drop in new orders in January. There's a theory that this could have a larger effect on the on airline companies and airline stocks. You know, and stocks have pulled back 3-4% in the last few weeks as this latest bit of bad news has come in. Boeing is one of just two airline manufacturers or airplane manufacturers, along with Airbus. I think that is actually an advantage. They got to get better. I think this could be a buying opportunity in airline stocks, just this dip. I wouldn't touch Boeing with an 11-foot pole, but I think you talked last year, and I'll let you talk about it now. You've been bullish on travel stocks, including airlines, and I don't think travel. I really don't think travel is going to slow down as a result of this. You know, I'm saying this as my wife is literally on a trip now where she had to fly somewhere, and she didn't think twice about it. Maybe others will think differently, but I don't think it'll be meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a flight coming up in May, and I double checked to make sure to see whether I was on an Airbus plane or if I was on a Boeing plane. Yep. The stock Boeing down 6% in the last 5 days, 11% in the last month, 27% year to date. The airlines in general have responded well. Alaska's flat year to date. The Jets ETF is up 5%. United Airlines up 7%, despite having a relatively large Boeing fleet. Southwest is flat, but they did lose 17, almost 18% in the last week because they rescinded guidance because so much of their guidance was premised on getting deliveries from Boeing.
Yeah.
I have heard FAA, or I read a story in which an FAA official said, hey, look, if Boeing doesn't clean up their act, we can rescind their production certification. So like they could actually shut down Boeing production if Boeing doesn't clean up. Boeing has been very profit focused for about the last 25 years since they merged with McDonnell Douglas in 97. They've been incentivizing people more on share prices than they have on product quality. Whatever your politics, there was an interesting last week tonight with John Oliver all about Boeing and their safety track record. And it actually does a decent job of explaining it. But I mean, I have seen journalists call for Boeing to be nationalized, right? Like the idea being you only have two aircraft suppliers. Safety is paramount. They have a long track record of cutting corners when it comes to safety. But because they're so important, maybe the U.S. nationalizes them, right? I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's sort of a black swan-y kind of risk, right? Where it's, I guess, if they're totally non-compliant, if their leadership is refusing to improve safety standards, right? Like maybe that is an ultimate outcome. As far as I'm concerned with like buying Boeing or investing in Boeing, it's really a bet on leadership at this point because they're getting tons of press. The injuries as a result of that 50-foot drop, the latest reporting I'd read on it is that it may have been an issue within the cockpit and not actually related to a mechanical failure or a mechanical deficiency in any way. But for as long as it's on people's minds, every time there's an issue with a Boeing plane specifically, they're going to be guilty until proven innocent. And that makes it really tough to be a shareholder. And, you know, God forbid anything serious arises. You know, obviously airlines are going to be hyper-focused on the safety of their Boeing fleet. They're going to be subjecting them to additional tests. The FAA is involved. They're going to be applying more oversight. You know, presumably Boeing is in their ongoing production is trying to right the ship and running a tight ship these days. But I don't know. The black swan outsized risk thing would probably have me steering clear of Boeing until they've shown clear signs that they're improving their corporate culture and reemphasizing safety in an appropriate way instead of incentivizing everybody on stock price performance, which, you know, has been bad and will continue to be bad if they're putting out subpar products where people's lives are on the line. Right.
Yeah. I guess I sort of equate it, and then we can stop talking about airlines. I said this to you off air. I mean, you remember when Chipotle was, you know, kept poisoning people accidentally, with, you know, making, was there lettuce also? I know you got your food poisoning a few weeks ago from lettuce. Was it, I can't remember if it was lettuce or some of their meats. Anyway, their E. coli was a big part of the equation there. And they kept doing it, and people, Chipotle stock sold off and people really avoided Chipotle's for a few months. And my thinking was, you know, we have one locally, which is always packed, and there's empty, just, you know, there's tumbleweeds blowing through it for months. I was like, this is the best time to go. Why? Because they have to be buttoned up now. They have to be on their A game. And it's comparing a, you know, a fast food place to an airline is totally apples to oranges. You know, even getting food poisoning isn't going to kill you. Whereas, you know, a door flying off of a Boeing 787 could, didn't thankfully, or 737. But I guess I view it as, you know, maybe this is, this recent incident notwithstanding, this is when they really need to be as buttoned up as possible. They know people, regulators are watching them. They've got to improve. And so maybe some people view it that way, but also, it's sort of an opportunistic time to buy airlines in general, especially with summer travel coming up, because they've gotten a Boeing dip. That's sort of the way I view it. Maybe that's being a little too cavalier about things, but we'll see.
I think airlines are going to become tough because, like we saw with Southwest, it's like that's sort of an aberration that they've got to pull back their earnings estimates. You can look at fleet size and maybe get a sense of who has most exposure to Boeing, but
yeah,
if there are systemic issues, excuse me, with Boeing safety, we also don't necessarily know what the next shoe to drop is. Like, okay, well, what if in the course of reviewing the safety procedures, they find that there's other deficiencies that impact other planes that we're not aware of in the Boeing fleets? I mean, I guess you could try and prioritize, but it becomes very difficult to try and game plan out all of the possible outcomes. So Chipotle, you mentioned, they had an E. coli outbreak in, I think, 2015 and early 2016. They lost 60% of their value until February of 2018. So even once they had resolved their issues, it still took about 2 years for them to turn around and then start heading higher. So I think that probably is a case for giving Boeing time to figure this out without looking at maybe an immediate value capture or trying to catch a falling knife, as it were.
Yeah, like I said, I would invest in Boeing. I mean, I just looked at Boeing in the last 5 years. The Boeing shares are down 46%. Now, granted, that's a couple of years of COVID is part of that, for sure. It's different because Chipotle doesn't supply to McDonald's and Burger King, Wendy's. Burger King's not public, but you know what I mean. That's why. Well, I wouldn't touch Boeing. Other stocks, you know, Delta was having a good year. Yeah, I think you mentioned the Jets ETF.
It's up 5% year to date. So
I would bet that would still be up. That'd be up more than that through the rest of the year. I guess that's all I'm really saying.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable pitch to make. You got to think that some of this Boeing reaction is already being priced in. We're heading into summer travel season. There are certainly certainly opportunities for airline companies to come out and overperform. Or even if it's just optics, if they come out and say, oh yeah, our Boeing fleet is being subject to double maintenance and double reviews, or right? Like you can come out and say something that doesn't actually materially cost you a lot from an operational standpoint and look like the good guy.
Right.
I mean, maybe consumers start pushing back on like bag fees. I know all those companies are now coming after carry-ons and cracking down on that. Fuel costs can always rise, right? Like there's all these sort of industry specific things that can arise, but I still remain largely bullish on airlines and travel stocks in particular. Of course, if we end up getting that sort of much feared but consistently avoided recession, that maybe makes me second guess that a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to our featured segment for today. So we're going to talk about called spring cleaning your portfolio. Yeah. We're getting towards spring in most areas of the country. Let's talk a little bit about that. We were going to talk about some sort of time-tested, you know, Cabot's been in business for more than half a century, 54 years now. There's a big reason for that. You know, we try and take care of our readers by not letting them have big losses, and then also by having them book profits on their winners. Those are, you know, we have some rules of thumb there that have sort of helped guide people. I'll let you sort of take the reins and sort of talk a little bit about some of your recommendations for, you know, now that we're moving to a new phase of the year. You know, early year exuberance is faded and the market's in a bit of a holding pattern, as we talked about. You know, the tax implications of the end of last year are in the rearview mirror. Talk about some of your sort of tips that you like to live by in terms of portfolio management.
So there's a distinction first between if you're a momentum trader and a value investor, and that comes to both, that's actually on both the profit taking side and the loss avoidance side. If you're profit taking as a value investor, you're probably doing it because you have a particular price target in mind when you bought a stock, right? So whether you're using earnings multiples, or if you're doing cash flow models, or if you're using analyst ratings or what have you, when you're buying because you feel that the market is not appropriately valuing a stock. If that stock gets cheaper, it just becomes a more attractive buy. Now, the difficulty there is you can't really implement a loss rule, right? If you're buying small cap momentum stocks, you can say, if I lose 30%, I'm selling this and I'm going elsewhere. If you're a value stock investor, conversely, if it loses 30%, it's now, you know, 30% more attractive. So you don't really have the hard and fast percentage rules on losses. It should really be an emphasis on what your perspective of the company is that distinguishes it from the way the market is pricing it. So some sort of a thesis about why a stock is grossly undervalued. Unfortunately, that makes the rule of thumb, you have to sort of throw the rule of thumb stuff out the window, and you have to be reliant on your own analysis or the analysis that you're relying on. But it makes profit taking a lot easier, because if you're buying a stock that's trading at 10 times earnings and you think it should be trading at 16 times earnings, if it gets to 16 times earnings, take your profit and you move on to the next opportunity. So it's sort of an inversal of what the momentum traders have. The momentum traders don't necessarily have an upside price target in mind when they get into a stock. It's sort of the nature of the momentum play. You want to ride it for as long as it'll run. You want to ride it as high as it'll go, but you don't necessarily know where that is. So what you do is you manage your downside risk. A lot of rules of thumb are, you know, 20%, 25% for losses from your initial entry price. For small cap stocks, you have to give them a little bit more room because they tend to be more volatile. And then as stocks rise, a lot of investors will put things like trailing stops in place, where, let's say you buy a stock and it goes up 20%, you move your sell stop up to like your entry price, right? So it's still a 20% loss, but now you're getting out without losing anything. If it keeps running higher, you raise your stop as well. And that helps protect profits, but then that makes the profit taking side of it more subjective. So one of the things that Jacob had written about, and
this Jacob Mintz, our Cabot chief analyst, Cabot options trader.
So he's operating with a ticking clock. So this isn't necessarily going to apply one-to-one with all growth stock investors or momentum stock investors. He likes to take profits on a third of his position when it's up 20%, another third if it's up 60 to 100%, and then he lets the balance run until he gets close to options expiration. You can probably put something similar in place if you're a growth investor, but you're probably going to want more aggressive targets than that, because frankly, it doesn't make a ton of sense to take a 20% profit in a strong momentum stock that is in the midst of a run upwards. You're probably looking at maybe more like a 50% profit take.
That's what Mike Santolo, who runs Cabot Growth Investor, Cabot Top 10 Trader, more Cabot Growth Investor, at least, is like a longer term investing portfolio than options trader. Options trader, you know, Jacob's trades are usually over the course of a few months, whereas you know, Mike likes to hold things for sometimes years. He recommends, as you mentioned, 50%. Something's up 50%, maybe sell a quarter or a third. 100%, you know, maybe you sell another quarter, another third, that kind of thing. So sort of similar to what you're mentioning with Jacob, but your timeline definitely it's timeline dependent.
Yeah, there's The advantage of profit taking is it also allows you to adhere to your system better, right? Ideally, you are buying a stock because of a particular price movement, a particular technical indicator, whatever it is that you are trading based on, got you into that stock. But human psychology doesn't really care about technical rules, so we have to be very disciplined when we're relying on those. And one thing that makes that easier is by reducing your risk exposure as your allocation to a particular investment goes up. But it's not just for value, or it's not just for momentum traders as well. Even if you're only investing in, say, a 401k, or if you are more of a set it and forget it investor, you're putting money into ETFs, there are also tactical reallocation strategies that you can employ. So if you find that your large cap exposure is getting overweight, which if you haven't looked at your portfolio in the last 6 months, I can almost guarantee that you have more large cap stocks than your asset allocation plan calls for, just given what large caps have done lately. Mm-hmm. What you do is you sell a portion of that to bring your overall allocation back into line, and then you use the proceeds from the sale to buy the underperforming asset class. So in this case, it's probably going to be small caps right now. They've remained laggards. I do still think there's a lot of tactical value in allocating more that way. But I think my overall takeaway is whatever strategy that you're using, however you're building your portfolio, this is a pretty good time to look back and just make sure that everything's in line with what your expectations are, both from a performance and from a percentage standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you said, we're past the new year, so all the window dressing, all the tax loss selling is done. We're through first quarter earnings. We really don't have a ton of catalysts on the horizon until summer. Summer is traditionally a slower period anyway. We're getting to that point where we would expect that whatever the market is doing come, say, the end of April, so about a month from now, we would expect it to largely continue to do the same thing through the May, June, July, August months. There's a reason that sell in May and go away is a saying. It stuff tends to sort of drift down or just sort of be a continuation, which likely means that if you're reallocating or if you're revisiting positions now, it's probably not at a high opportunity cost. I mean, we never know. You never know what news is coming and how the market might respond to it. But you are probably at a period right now where your opportunity cost for rebalancing is relatively low, or for taking profits. We've had a huge run up. We've captured, I think, 60% of the gains that most Wall Street analysts have been calling for year to date, although those get revised constantly. And we're only 2.5 months into the year. So having some outsized early performance in the year is probably a good opportunity for profit taking if you haven't done so. And especially as we see the narrative change, right? You and I were talking about that earlier, where we're seeing maybe a slowdown in some of the early leaders. Take some profits off the table if you're overinvested into some of those names. And that doesn't mean sell out like they're going to nothing, because that's probably not the case. But if you have 10% of your portfolio in NVIDIA and now it's up to 15%, maybe you pare it back to 12%. It warrants being very intentional with portfolio management right now, because we are in sort of a transition phase with that bull market, because we're in sort of a low opportunity cost time to do so. And then if you have some bad laggards and you're not buying for value reasons, reassess the position and try and identify whether you should cut bait with them or continue investing, or even, you know, adding more to the position if it's deeply undervalued and you think that Wall Street is just not understanding the buying proposition for it.
Yeah, I like to cut laggards in bull markets. You know, giving stocks a rope. You know, 20% loss limit is sort of what I usually live by. Not hard and fast, but generally. I know I adopted that from Mike Santolo, but in bear markets, more like a 15% limit. You know, you can give it a little more of a leash in markets like this one. But you know, like I said, that's part of how Cabot has stated business is we rarely let anyone take a loss more than about 20%. Now, you know, for like Tyler London with small caps, I think it's probably a little more than that.
30,
like
35, I think.
Yeah. But like for, you know, large cap growth stock, you know, I think 20% is usually Mike's limit. And that's sort of what I usually go by, you know, not falling in love with a stock or a name and just cheerleading. Just sort of coldly cutting bait is a good way. You know, if you have, so you have 10 stocks in a portfolio, in your portfolio, and 8 are up and 2 are down, and one of them is down a lot, you know, if it's down 20% plus, now get rid of it. You know, you don't, in this market, there's no need to have something like that in your portfolio.
That's part of the value with the, you know, you talk about giving stuff a little bit of, like trying to determine how much rope to give something. One of the added benefits of partial profit taking, if you're doing it on the way up, is if you are having difficulty just cutting bait, coldly cutting bait, as I believe you put it, if you've taken some profits, you can build a little bit more wiggle room in. So if you really, you know, we look at what, like momentum story charts, or what's Mike's big three? It's
so story number it? Chart snack.
So, yeah. Story number chart.
Story so number let's say, and chart. Yeah.
Let's say that the story is really, really good, right? You love Portillo's, right? It's a retail play. It's trying to grow really quickly. It's trying to build out across the U.S. If let's say you absolutely love the story, if you've had, you know, if you have a good run with it, you take partial profits and the numbers start falling a little bit short, but you still love the story, you can give it a little bit more wiggle room if you've got a profit cushion there. Whereas if you haven't taken profits, you're now, well, let's say it retraces, it comes back to your buy point. Now you're looking at a loss. You take partial profits on the way up because then you can implement a little bit of discretion if you wanted to like overweight the story versus the numbers. I mean, we're not robots. We're people. We're subject to the emotional whims of the market, right? There's a reason that bubbles happen. There's a reason that stuff gets over. The reason for the saying of buy when there's blood in the streets, even if it's your own, is human nature overreacts to external stimulus. And that means overselling. And then on the flip side of it, overbuying. So don't treat yourself as like a perfect trading robot. Give yourself some room to be human and, you know, take profits. So then you can get out of a position with a little bit of a gain, or you can allow it to become a little bit of a loss because you've already got some profits on the books. Sorry, bringing up Portillo's right now. Love that place. Down 22% in the last 6 months. So, all right. So if you love the story.
What is Portillo's? Is this an Arizona thing? I don't even know.
No, it's a Chicago hot dog and Italian beef restaurant. Oh, it's a fast food restaurant. And they're trying to expand nationwide. I think they IPO'd pretty recently, 2021. October of 2021, they're down 65% since then. They're trading at all-time lows right now at $12.87 a share.
Bad time for hot dogs, I guess.
Bad time for hot dogs, but I mean, they're trading at a 40-time PE ratio, but less than a billion market cap. I don't hate that. I don't hate Portillo's at this price. But that's because I'm in love with
stomach investing
story.
For you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Appetite. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Italian beef. Get a Chicago dog. Drag it through the garden. Maybe get a shake or slice of cake. It's fantastic.
Well, that's a good. It's lunchtime in the East Coast now, so that's a good as any place to wrap up. I'm getting hungry just hearing you talk about that. Those are some spring cleaning tips. And you know, they've done our readers, our subscribers well, for decades. And, you know, Brad, I think some of those are, what you've used in your past life as a financial advisor, and that, I trust has served them well as well. Any last tip to add or words of wisdom to add before we sign off?
Yeah, maybe don't go buying Portillo's. They've got 10 million cash on hand, 500 million in debt outstanding. So they are trading at like 50% of their outstanding debt value. Maybe wait for that one to get a little bit cheaper.
Yeah, there goes my idea for starting a hot dog business. Okay, well, that's it for us on Street Check this week. Thanks for joining us. And we will be back with a new episode next Friday.